Well, let's start. I'm pleased anybody came tonight. I think for those of you who traveled today and then came to dinner and then the fire alarm and then just to come to a session tonight, I think is no small thing. So and it does seem a little strange to be doing Saturday night sessions, so we'll kind of go at this as gently as possible, but let me just say a word of introduction to this whole project, and eventually I'm going to use the board, and if you want to sit closer so that you can see it more adequately, and I need to tell the people on the Tate Ministry that we're beginning now. And this session tonight focuses on how what I will be speaking of as the renewal movement that I think Jesus led became what we think of as Christianity, or at least the sort of the germ that became Christianity. And this is a topic that, while in one way it stands alone, is part of a much larger project that I've been working on for a number of years now, which has to do with how we Christians might understand ourselves more adequately, more fully, in light of a truer portrait of Judaism. When I was a graduate student studying Bible, I learned a lot of things about the early church, about the ministry of Jesus and so forth, that gave me a new understanding of Judaism. When I began to think about how I sort of inherited the Christian story, I realized that a lot of what I had inherited, simply just sort of growing up in the church, was really not a very accurate portrait of Judaism. So my quest is to find a new way of telling this story, and I think it has to do with almost every aspect of the life of the church next week. In fact, the last session that I will do will be on the liturgy of the church and how we might pray differently. But there are these separable pieces to kind of get at night after night, and so the piece that tonight, you sort of come now sort of number four in the sequence, has to do with how we imagine Jesus. You know, we usually think of Jesus as sort of the first Christian. And the Christian movement certainly originates with Jesus, but we don't really do him justice if we make him a Christian right away. In fact, we don't do the 12 or the men and women who are disciples of Jesus much justice when we think of them as Christians, because what we do is we take away the kind of lively character of the decisions that had to be made in the early church about who we were. So what I would like to do is to try out a few ideas on you, and I'm going to stop at various junctures for questions or comments. And in fact, I think you should know that if I don't stop, you should feel free to stop me if you have a question or comment. You know how people get who've been teaching for years. We can go on and on. And even if we don't know, we'll go on and on. And so you just have to break it up, and I don't want any. And also, about halfway through, I'll try to remember to have a little stand-up break, because I have discovered that these chairs are wonderful if you're an ascetic, but they're not. They don't exactly sort of conform to the average body type. So tonight I really just want to commend especially the people who just arrived. So thank you for coming. So the bottom line today is, how did we get from Jesus to the church or to Christianity? And so I'd like to start with a word about Jesus, which does seem very appropriate. I did more of this last night when I talked about the Jewish world of Jesus, and I dealt with some of the lively controversies that were happening in the first century in among Jews, and tried to place Jesus in a sort of context to show that there were some fairly extreme views about, well, things that, at least in hindsight to us, looked like fairly extreme views, and place Jesus probably on a spectrum in which he's probably more like the Pharisees in certain aspects. I thought it would be useful to pick up a third piece of that tonight and start there, and so that's why I provided Bibles. I mean, you had you pick up Bibles. So if you look at Mark 7, we might use that as a point of departure. Mark 7 is a fairly typical controversy between Jesus and the Pharisees, but it is distinctive to Mark in one particular way that I will point out shortly. I won't read the whole passage because you have it in front of you, but just to make sure we all are on board with the basic plot. We have the Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus. And they noticed that some of his disciples were eating with defiled hands, that is, without washing them. And you'll note that Mark, as the narrator here, has appended a parenthetical comment. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders. And they do not eat anything from the market unless they wash it. And there are also many other traditions that they observe, the washing of cups, pots, and bronze kettles. Let's hope they don't have the same problem that our dish room has this evening. You know, the cause of the fire was that the dishwasher exploded. So.
But no one was hurt.
But no one was hurt, thanks be to God. But the people who are doing the cups, the pots, and the bronze kettles are going to be there. they're going to be there, I'm afraid, for a very long time this evening. At any rate, so you have the Pharisees and scribes testing Jesus, asking him, why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands? And then you'll notice that Jesus here cites Isaiah. Notice that he calls the Pharisees hypocrites by turning it to them. Isaiah prophesied rightly about you hypocrites. And then notice the very telling verse 8. You abandon the commandment of God and hold to human tradition. It's going to make a little editorial comment that we Christians have used that over against one another. Anyway. So 9, that is developed a little bit about how they have chosen human tradition over the commandment of God. And then in verse 14, he returns to this theme of defilement. Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are. And then continue in the rest of the passage. So he goes back to the house. The disciples are asking him what he's just said, and which is one of the theme in Mark's Gospels, that the disciples are the last to get it. Then do you fail also to understand? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile, since it enters not the heart, but the stomach, and goes out into the sewer? And then this parenthetical comment. Thus he declared all foods clean. I'm going to, you know, if you would sort of visually underline that, it's a very important comment that Mark is making in this text. And then I think we know very much the rest of this passage. It is what comes out of a person that defiles. For it is from within, from the human heart, that evil intentions come. Fornication, theft, murder, adultery, avarice, and so forth. Now, there were a couple people here in the room who were here when I began last week doing a whole session on the Pharisees. So this is always one of the problems in this. You know, there's so many teaching opportunities for people at Holden that it's always difficult to try to keep going and then to have to keep pointing back to, well, we talked about the Pharisees, we did a whole hour on them, and here now we're going to get the 30-second version. But this is a very typical passage in the Gospels in which the Pharisees sort of were seeking to entrap Jesus. It doesn't seem to be although in this case it may be more like a genuine question, and in which they are upholding human tradition, and it seems to be much more legalistic, and what it really does is it misses the mark because it emphasizes the external. The washing of hands is what somehow makes a person impure, instead of what we all know is that how you are impure because of what is within you. So this, you know, this certainly speaks to the common sense. But what happens is that we Christians, reading a text like this, are presuming or assuming that this is the way it was in Judaism, that all Jews had these laws about purity in terms of food, washing one's hands before eating and so forth, and that the Pharisees are representative of this point of view, and it's just sort of one more nail in the coffin of legalistic Judaism. Now, I'd like to point out a couple of strange things, actually one strange thing in this passage, because only Mark Matthew and Luke have the same story, but they have it in a, what did I say, Matthew and Luke? I have to keep it straight here. They have the same passage, but they do not have the parenthetical comment, "Thus he declared all foods clean." Now remember, those of you who were here before, that one of the essentials of Jewish life, one of the practices, one of the ways that you know who you are as a Jew in the Greco-Roman society, is that you have certain customs about food. There are certain things that you eat and certain things that you do not eat, and there are certain ways that you go about doing them. And by and large, insofar as we can generalize about first century Judaism, Jews kept this. Now, some groups emphasized it more than others. But it would have been an extraordinarily strange thing for Jesus to say, in essence, the dietary laws don't matter. And the reason that I think this is anomalous in this text is if you recall Paul and the controversies that are at the heart of Acts 15, a big problem in the early church is, do the Gentiles who come into belief in Jesus, do they have to be A, circumcised if they're male, and B, do they have to keep the dietary laws? And if you recall, Paul's on one side and Peter and James are on the other. And you recall the whole experience that Peter has at Joppa and the whole, you know, the encounter with Cornelius, the centurion. So my sense of things is that this particular passage most likely reflects what's happening in Mark's church right around the year 70, in which you're sort of at the tail end of a very bitter war between the Jews and the Romans, which the Romans won. And it looks like Mark doesn't want his community associated with other Jews because this is a very bad time to be Jewish, especially if you're living anywhere in the Jerusalem area or anywhere in first century Palestine. And what I'm trying to sort of point at here is that the way a text like this gives us a fairly negative idea of the purity laws, which were one of the central practices of Judaism. And it's one of the things that happens, I was trying to think of this in terms of some of the debate about the Reformation and all of the post-Reformation debates in which various Christian denominations have had a criticism about the way, say, another community worships. But then it becomes tied into a polemic, and instead of it being instead of becoming a criticism, it becomes a caricature of what the community really does. Let me give an example that's a little disconnected from the Reformation so that we can all leave here speaking to each other. I had the privilege of going to Rome for a meeting of Jewish and Christian women last fall. And we happened to be meeting on property that was right next door to a church and to a monastery. And so one day at a break, we just walked over to see it. It was mostly just to kind of get out of the meeting room for a while. And I was accompanied by a young Israeli woman who was Jew. So we walked into this church, and Catholic church, and I have to say, it wouldn't be my cup. I mean, it was too many things in it for me. I mean, taste architecturally wise. And she walked in, and this woman, very, very open, she said, "Look at all the idols," meaning the statues and so forth. And I said to her, and I probably should have explained this beforehand, that one of the Yiddish terms that you often hear Jews use about sort of things, kind of, are tchotchkes, kind of, you know, decorations and so forth. And I said, "Well, Marcia, what if you thought of these not as idols?" Because remember, in the Jewish tradition, there is a fairly strong prohibition. They don't have, in synagogues and so forth, they don't have pictures of human beings and so forth. But what if you looked at them not as idols, but as tchotchkes? As things that this particular Italian Catholic parish has that in some way help them get to God. Not replacing God or whatever. It's just, Now, I don't know that I made a major breakthrough in terms of interreligious understanding here, but it does make a difference, you know, how you understand how another community practices. And one of the things that is very important for understanding what Jesus is doing in regard to the purity laws is that I think, like Unlike, say, some Jews, who, particularly those who were the community from whom we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, that Jesus didn't put a major emphasis on the purity laws. He doesn't make a big deal about it. Presumably, since he ate with a lot of marginal people, tax collectors and sinners and others, any traditions that we have to do about hand washing and so forth, I suspect they were fairly, I don't think he made a big deal about it. I suspect that Jesus would have kept whatever customs. By the way, it's not accurate that the Pharisees had a lot of rules about hand washing and that all Jews in general. So this shows that while Mark knows something about what's happening in first century Palestinian Judaism, he's actually not a particularly accurate reporter here. Now, I don't want anybody to get worried. You know, the New Testament doesn't, the truth of the scriptures do not stand or fall on whether or not they were factually correct about certain things. After all, these are you know, the inspiration of God does not depend upon facticity. Here you have, I think, a real problem in what adds up to, over the time, our generalization, not just about Jesus and the Pharisees, but that somehow all of the dietary laws of Judaism and the other purity laws are simply a sign of legalism among Jews. Instead of understanding that, say, the dietary laws were one of the practices, and if I can connect this to Dorothy Bass's book, Practicing Our Faith, were one of the practices of household economics. I have a very close Jewish friend who happens to be a Reformed Jew who keeps a kosher home. And those of you who have Jewish friends who keep kosher know that this is not simply a matter of not eating pork or not mixing meat and dairy, but that it involves everything, including having meat dishes and dairy dishes. And I must admit that when I go to a home, I have to be pretty careful the first time I do dishes, because there's the dishcloth for the meat dishes, and there's the dishcloth, and there's this part of the sink, and so forth. Now, this is not a legal business with her. It's not a trivial thing. She simply says this: because I pay attention to what I eat, to what dishes I'm using, I mean, you know, the kitchen's the center of a household, right? I never forget I'm a Jew. That's all. Now, that doesn't impel me to keep kosher. I mean, or you know, whatever the equivalent is. But in other words, instead of, it's so easy for us to judge, well, those are very strange laws. Why, after all, why can't you, if you have a chicken dinner, why can't you have a glass of milk or a dish of ice cream afterwards? Well, because in our community, this is how we do things this way. And I think that if we could understand that the dietary laws, which were sort of a subsection of these larger commands about purity, were simply ways that Jews had of identifying who they were in the practicalities of everyday life. Does that make sense to you? I mean, it may not be our things. And in fact, in Christianity, many of our traditions, we've kind of, you know, let go of some of those defining customs. We realize that I don't think there's anything intrinsically religious or irreligious about eating particular foods, but they are ways of defining us. So when you come to Holden Village, one of the things that defines the life of Holden Village is a simple diet. So that we have certain dietary, not, you know, we think of them as, you know, dietary laws in the loose sense. That is, here at Holden, it's a largely vegetarian diet, though not exclusively. Here at Holden, there's a great attempt to respect the environment. We don't eat a lot of meat, not just for monetary reasons, but because of the whole cycle of what it means to have to give grain to cows and so on and so on and so on. So even though I'm just using one small example here from Mark 7, what I'm trying to point to is that I do not think that Jesus was opposed, in this instance, to the dietary laws of Judaism. But what I think is that Jesus would have kept them, that what he was trying to lead was a renewal movement within Israel. And in his renewal movement, this particular aspect of Jewish life was sort of a taken for granted, but that he emphasized other things. And here he differs more sharply from another group of Jews who lived down in the wasteland. That sort of shows my biases, you know, but in the around the Dead Sea, and it's this incredibly hot, dusty area, and who, for whom the stringent keeping of the laws of purity, particularly the dietary laws, was of the essence because they saw that that's how you kept your identity separate rather than assimilate. Now, that's just a little case in point. I want to drop back to some larger sort of dynamics about the movement from Jesus to Christianity. But before I move on, I'll take some time for any questions or comments, or if you feel a little, you're not quite sure what I just did with this passage or whatever, it's time to probe it.
Sometimes I wonder why we get hung up, why we want to keep our identity. It says you're supposed to lose yourself and don't concentrate on yourself as an individual.
But if you think that in some way we're embodied, then it seems to me that also has to happen for the religious community, that I think the trick is, how do you have some kind of markers, boundary markers, as it were, from ordinary life that help to distinguish a community, give them a feeling of oneness, without it being an impermeable barrier to other people? And I think what happens for a lot of communities is that then the barrier becomes impermeable, and it becomes a sort of a group withdrawn from the world or whatever. Think of communities that have much more definable boundaries. Think of something like the Amish, of what they do and don't do, and how it is that, what do you give into in modern technology as a religious community? That would be, if you had to do purity laws today, I think that would be one of the areas in which, if you look at the range of Christian denominations, it's interesting to me that the Amish would be at one end of the spectrum, right? They don't own cars, they don't send their children to colleges and universities, they live a very, very simple lifestyle, the dresses, I don't know that it's, well, I think a certain kind, I don't imagine most Amish women wear shorts and that kind of thing, right? Now, if you just look at technology, that they think they have electricity. I don't know that much.
No.
They don't have electricity.
They don't have electricity. Okay, so no electricity. Now take the other end of the spectrum. You might have something like fundamentalist churches that are very sophisticated technologically, right? I mean, you've got a prayer concern, you call an 800 number, and you get somebody on the other end of the line and listens to your concern. They've invested a tremendous amount of money in television, super duper churches that have of course, for many of us in our churches, the problem has less to do with the attitude toward technology than it even has to do with funding, right? But we're kind of, I think most people from Christian churches who come to Holden, their churches are sort of in the middle of all of this. I doubt there are too many people who come from church backgrounds in which they refuse to use electricity. And yet increasingly, as we realize the vulnerability of the planet, we're beginning to realize that we have to use the world's resources in a much more sensitive and attentive way than we have heretofore. So what I'm trying to point to is that first century Judaism had a range of ways that the practices were carried out. And Jesus, in his movement, and I should say a word, but I want to call it Jesus' movement. We really can't talk of Jesus and the disciples in a historically accurate fashion if we call them Christians. Right? I mean, they don't keep, there isn't, all of what they do is done as Jews. Jesus goes to the synagogue. Jesus does certain things that Jews do. Here he's pictured as arguing with one interpretation of purity laws. All through the gospel, Jesus interacts virtually entirely with other Jews. He talks about the disciples being sent out to the lost sheep of Israel. You can almost count on one hand Jesus' encounters with non-Jews. There's the woman who's variously called a Canaanite woman or the Syrophoenician woman. There's a centurion whose son he heals. I got two that came right on. In other words, Jesus is a Jew interacting with other Jews, who has a profound vision for a restored Israel, for an Israel that would be much more open to and committed to the reign of God, an Israel that would take to heart that the God to whom they are bound in covenant is merciful and gracious. And that seems to me to be at the heart of what Jesus was preaching. Now, one of the things you have to ask yourself, was there anything in the preaching of Jesus that was threatening? So if you would just think for a minute, if you would just imagine that instead of being Holden Village was a Christian retreat center, that we happen to have Holden Village now in first century Palestine, and we're a group of Jews doing the same kind of thing. We have come to Holden Kibbutz for renewal. And there's only one teacher on the staff this week, and it's this Jesus of Nazareth, and he's teaching in not just in the fireside room, he's next door in the village center. And you're listening to Jesus. What, if anything, would you find threatening or you'd go away? One of my favorite sayings about the parables is that when Jesus was telling parables, the people were utterly fascinated. And then, there's usually in the parables, there's a twist at the end, sort of a surprising ending, or you know, something you're not really ready to hear. And one biblical scholar, John Dominic Crossan, says that he thinks that people sort of stood in the crowds and said, "I'm not sure I get what you're saying, but if I do, I don't like it." Okay? So just let's take a minute. It's hot and whatever. So instead of listening to me for a minute, maybe you could just talk among yourselves. Is there anything in the teachings of Jesus that you... We're going to presume everybody is a 20th century Christian. We're all on board with the teaching of Jesus. But just say you're in the first century. You're hearing him for the first time. Is there anything that he says that just kind of you find difficult to deal with? Okay, just let's take some time in groups of three or four, just for a minute, just to kind of change the dynamic a little bit, and you don't have to listen to me on vacation. So just take 5 minutes. Can I get a little sampling from what you come up with? Just doesn't give you enough time to really think deeply, but just the starter, somebody, one thing that you would find a little problematic.
Giving up everything.
Giving up everything. You would find that problematic? Why? Don't we all find it so easy? Okay.
If I were young, I think I might be more open. And if I were older, I would have
Okay, spin that out a little bit. Why would you find it difficult? Why do you find it difficult because you're not 18 anymore? I hope I haven't.
Yeah, because of the materialism and the and his suggestion about Jesus sounded as if he was blaspheming to call himself the light. I would take offense maybe if I was, you know, 50. Might be more open if I was 20.
Okay, get a little settled.
I need to hear more about that because I think it's exactly the opposite.
Okay, well, sorry.
Because if young people look forward to accumulating or doing something, and maybe getting their share of things, so to me it's sometimes the older you get, the more you realize you don't need those kinds of things.
On the other hand, you have a tradition.
So that's true.
If Jesus
true.
Is going against your tradition
right.
that you've had for 50 years or 45 years, yeah. and he's saying something that's traditionally not your tradition, then the older you are, the more stage you are in your tradition. Whereas young people be more open to a charismatic preacher who comes in and says something. That would be mine.
But maybe it would depend on what kind of situation you were in life, too, as far as... you know, not just age, but other factors.
I suspect there are a lot of variables in terms of personality. Yes. When you think of certain people, they don't have to be too old
right.
necessarily. That you know, they died on the vine when they were 15.
Right.
And, you know,
mm-hmm.
right. But we always do it this way. And anybody who was always, we always did it this way, I don't think they were really sort of naturally open to Jesus. I'm not saying God's grace can't do a lot, but you know, because Jesus had a very fresh vision for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, fresh visions are great when you're the generation in hindsight. But when you're trying to be recreated, it's pretty painful. Well, we don't know how old the disciples were. We have no idea. They don't tell us. What else? Would you?
They may not tell us, but I suspect they were younger.
Well, probably. Well, Jesus was probably, you know. But again, this was a society in which people didn't live so long either.
Right.
And we'd all be over by now.
There's a stereotype that young people are flexible and old people aren't.
That's right.
I haven't found that to be true at all.
Okay, but I think there's probably more to do with personality type or whatever. Who knows? But what else might be problematic in the teaching of Jesus?
That there's the same God for all of us, whether we're either a non-believing prostitute or tax collector or a practicing Jew.
Okay, and why is that a problem?
Because we're doing the right thing, so we get there. Then they're not doing the right thing, so they shouldn't.
That's right. Not fair, right?
Right. It's not fair.
What kind of a kingdom is it? I mean, how fair does God play when the people... I've been out working in the field the whole day, and it's 93 degrees, and you come along at the last hour, and we get the same amount of pay. Now, is that fair?
No.
No.
What if God doesn't play by our... I mean, do you see why good people could take offense at Jesus?
Certainly.
Because, you know, his God... The thing is, when Jesus preaches a God was merciful and gracious, that sounds wonderful. We all want God to be merciful and gracious to us. Mm-hmm. But if I'm trying to live a righteous life, and I really make sacrifices for that, and then I see, you know, some poor, dumb... You know, not more than, you know, just see somebody who lives in an outrageous lifestyle. The last thing I want for my children or whatever, I don't really want God to be so merciful and gracious to that person. Let me tell you a little story, maybe that could get at that. A number of years ago, I was teaching a New Testament class at Boston College. And in this particular class, as was often the case with undergraduates, it was a real struggle to get them really involved in the dynamic of the text. They wanted to, if I could have just lectured, and they could have just taken notes, and then if I would have given them true-false questions on my lecture, they would have been happy, because it would have been a nice, you know, a class that they kind of knew what was going on. But I was trying to get them involved in the message of Jesus, and I don't think you can just do that by listening. So when we were teaching the parables in particular, I tried to do some kind of experiment. Well, that didn't work too often. But anyway, I taught this parable about the workers in the vineyard from the 20th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. And I set up this little scenario that I had learned from a friend who has a background in drama, which is kind of a little improvisation, where I have, you know, there's sort of three sets of workers. They're hired early in the morning, they're hired various hours during the day, and then there's the 11th hour worker, which I have made you. So I had them be in groups of three and identify with one of the three, early, middle, or late. And then I read them the parable and I got up to the scene about the payment. If you recall, in the way Matthew tells the parable, it's very, very clever, the way Jesus is telling the parable in Matthew, because the workers are lined up in reverse order so that you think that the people who came last, they get paid first. So you're kind of set up to think that the people who come last are going to get more, which of course doesn't happen. So the point was, after they got paid, then they were to continue the conversation as if the three of them, who'd all gotten the same pay, had to go walk home together and kind of argue it out. Well, they did it dutifully, but I distinctly remember walking back to my class thinking, my office thinking, well, you try everything, but, you know, they kind of did it because they thought, you know, it's the weird theology teacher, you might as well, you know, they don't want it. Well, get in their bad side, she might give you a B, and or worse. So, but it didn't have any, I didn't feel like it took, that they really got the twist of the parable. Well, I think this is 1985. I don't have a great mind for retention of detail, but the infamous Boston Red Sox, who haven't won a World Series since, I don't know, 1909 or...
Who knows when?
Since a long time, that's
right.
For sure. So that particular year, they were in the playoffs, with the California Angels. I only happen to remember that because they were playing out on the West Coast that week. I'm not that much, I'm sort of a fickle baseball fan, but you know, this was sort of exciting. The Sox might go to the World Series, and here's the last playoff before they get there. And so they had a paper due, say, a Tuesday class, and Monday night, I'd stayed up till 1:30 in the morning watching this broadcast from the West Coast. I never stay up till 1:30 in the morning, but whatever. So I came into class the next morning, and I'm sort of chatting at the beginning, and I said, wasn't that exciting that we beat the Angels last night going to the World Series? And I said, by the way, you know, the essay is due today, but if you stayed up watching the series and didn't get your paper done, just hand it in on Thursday. And there was this little group of folks over in this part of the classroom. You know what? They hadn't watched the baseball game because their mean old theology teacher had a paper due the next day. And they were angry that I had extended the deadline. So in one of those rare moments, those great but few teachable moments, I said, do you remember the parable we did a couple of weeks ago about the workers in the vineyard? Yeah, but that's different. That was back then. I said, yeah, but that's the point. You were a little irritated at me because I extended the deadline, and you were a very diligent student, and you did what you should have been doing. And I kind of gave a grace period to the procrastinators and the baseball fans and whatever. And I understand why you're irritated, because I'd be on your side. I was sort of, you know, I was the dutiful type. But God doesn't just love the dutiful people. Remember the parable of the prodigal son that Jesus tells?
Yes.
You know, here's the son who goes off and does heavy-duty sinning. It isn't sorry at all. He's only hungry, which is why he comes back. And there's the grumbling, dutiful elder brother who can never reconcile. And clearly in Jesus' telling, God's predilection is for the lost. And if you don't identify with the lost, you know, I could see myself sitting in the village center listening to Jesus and saying, I don't want God to be like that. I want God to be on my side. So what I'm saying now, I think Jesus led a renewal movement, and I'm going to call it Jesus' renewal movement. There's sort of a fashion in New Testament scholarship to speak about Jesus' movement, to get at historically the time before you had a Christianity as such. But I don't call it Jesus' movement because I don't think it was a movement that he led about himself. I think it was a movement about the renewal of Israel's covenant with God, and God was at the center. Jesus preached about God, who God was, and what God called for. And that I have no doubt that Jesus upset many of his contemporaries. But I, where I take issue is the way the church so often, people in the church so often, talk about his contemporaries as if they were bad-willed or narrow-minded, rigorous, legalist types because they failed to recognize Jesus as the Christ. First of all, it wasn't all that clear. What we call messianic prophecies oversimplifies a huge a complex reality about how Jews thought about the Messiah. But more importantly, because what Jesus taught was not so easy to really, A, to grasp, and B, to take in, because it called for too much transformation, which is still the same problem we have, right? Jesus, if you really love the gospel, it calls for an awful lot of transformation. You can't just say, at you know, whatever age, I've got it now. I mentioned last night a wonderful book called The Shadow of the Galilean, and I'd just like to read a short passage from it. I recommend this very highly. This is sort of a way of studying the message of Jesus by way of an imaginative rendering of it by a world-class New Testament scholar. But this is written as a narrative, not as an analytical piece. It's one of the best books I've ever read on the sort of the historical Jesus. And he sets up these characters. In one chapter, you have a couple, Joanna and Cusa. And Cusa works in Herod's court. So he would be an upper-class Jew who works in the court of Herod Antipas, who was the ruler in Galilee during the lifetime of Jesus. And Joanna, his wife, becomes quite taken by the teachings of Jesus. And her husband is not so taken with him. So there's this dialogue between them. And her husband protests this way. He says, why does he present his teaching only to the little people? Why doesn't he come to Tiberias, which was the great city, one of the two great cities that Herod Antipas had built? Why doesn't he teach Antipas? Why doesn't he, you know, go to, no, I'll be your teacher. I can think of only one answer. He dreams the dreams of little people. And in response, his wife Joanna says, of course he dreams the dreams of little people. He's not addressing the rich and powerful. But what does he want to do? These little people are bent double by their toil. He wants them to walk upright. They're bowed down by cares. He wants them to be free from cares. There are people who feel insignificant. He gives them the feeling that their life has meaning. And you're all worried about that. All of you and Herod Antipas, you're worried that the little people might come to feel that they're not little people. So you've spread the rumor that you want to kill Jesus so that he disappears over the frontier, so that he leaves you in peace, so that the little people don't hit on rebellious notions and become a danger to you. And when I read that, it just struck me as so profound that in to Jesus, the sense that people aren't little anymore is the real basis of a sort of insurrection in a society in which the peasants really were bent double by toil. And so, we talked at the beginning about, you know, a little argument here about, you know, what if we were more settled or less settled, whether we'd be open to Jesus. But I suspect you could make the argument that for people of prominence in society, the teaching of Jesus was sort of doubly threatening. A, it asked you to examine what you were doing with your possessions, but B, it asked you to recognize these other people, you know, that they were real people and that their concerns mattered. And I'm not so sure that we've really come to that in society, you know, that the marginal people really, really do matter to us in the church, that they really, really do matter to God. So, just to recapitulate, I'm trying to suggest that Jesus worked as a teacher in Israel with a reform movement, a renewal movement. There were other reform movements. The Pharisees represented one such. The group down at Qumran represented another, though they withdrew from society to do it. And Jesus' reform movement, his vision for renewal, would have made him, if not in some quarters, enemies, but it also would have raised a lot of eyebrows, and it never made things entirely clear for everybody. It's not clear how Jesus really felt, say, about the temple or about Roman rule or whatever. There were a lot of things that sort of left. It's as if Jesus was saying, the reign of God is coming, it is near, we must change our lives. And that he tells these parables, but we don't have from Jesus, you know, the 55 ways you're supposed to live, or the 13 norms, or the new 10 commandments, or whatever. I mean, even the Beatitudes, which might come closest to a list, are so poetic that they take a long time to figure out what they mean. Now, the earliest disciples of Jesus, if you will, sort of the first generation of disciples, it seems to me what they were trying to do, if you think of after the crucifixion and after the resurrection and the giving of the Spirit. So let's talk about, you know, Peter, James, John, post-Pentecost, and then very early on somehow in this mix comes this one who was not part of the 12 or one of the disciples of Jesus during his ministry, but of course this is Saul, who becomes Paul. Now, for these people, let's call them, instead of calling them Christians right away, let's simply call them believers in Jesus. And that the major question, it seems to me, that they're trying to confront is, who are we as believers in Jesus? And one of the subtexts of that is, who are we as believers of Jesus who are, by our formation in faith, Jews? And what is there about our Jewish heritage that we retain as believers in Jesus? And what is it we might let go? I mean, how does this change us? And it seems that one way of looking at this is that by, say, the 60s of the first century, so roughly 25 to 30 years after the death of Jesus, you have believers trying to figure, and remember, there's no New Testament yet. There are no Gospels written down. What you have, the scriptures of Jesus, are the scriptures of the Jewish people. I think they read these scriptures with new eyes now, because they have a new lens, and that's the life of Jesus. So when they read something like what we have come to call, although they weren't selected out at that period, the suffering servant songs in Isaiah that talk about by his stripes we are healed, I can see very easily how after the crucifixion and resurrection, you would read a passage like that, or of course I say read a passage in a society in which not very many people were literate. It was more like hear a passage, and many people would have known, if not the entire Torah by heart, would have known, you know, great swatches of it by heart. But when they hear a passage like that, they can't help but think of Jesus. So that they see kind of a new level of meaning in the old text. But as in most religious communities, where the rubber hits the road has to do with practices. What practices should we keep, and what? And this wasn't a big deal until the until non-Jews came. Now the question is, you've got all these non-Jews, they're coming into our community, they like us believe in Jesus. So, do they keep the purity laws? Do we circumcise the males who come to us? Now, again, I think from the hindsight of the 20th century, these may seem like pretty mundane questions. But remember, the Christian community gets divided on how do we confess our sins? You know, is there someone who mediates it, or do we go directly to God? You know, forgiveness is a practice all Christians should hold in common. But exactly how you do it, there has been some pretty vociferous disagreement, right? So the same thing is happening, and I put up this chart then about, this is sort of, I think, one way of sorting out how the believers in Jesus, who probably are now called Christians by this time, Christianoi in the Latin means partisans of Christ. But the difficulty of calling them Christians is that it implies that somehow they're a separate religion, and that doesn't take place for quite some time. So I'm going to keep calling them believers in Jesus. There are, at least it seems to me, and this, anytime you can put things in a chart, it helps because it makes things clearer, but of course it always oversimplifies. So I'm not trying to say these are the only four positions, but these are four positions that we can discern from some of the epistles of Paul and also from the Acts of the Apostles, and then from some later texts. So I realize, so let me do first what I think the four positions, how they might be named. I think you have some who believe that if you are a believer in Jesus, you observe fully the Mosaic Law. You do exactly as we were taught to do. And this view was associated particularly with the group in Jerusalem, or at least some believers in Jerusalem. There are a few indices of that in Acts of the Apostles, in the 11th chapter, 2nd verse, and the 15th chapter, the 5th verse. This view clearly doesn't win out, but it was one of the early strata about what it meant to be a believer in Jesus, and it makes a lot of sense, after all. I think we can presume that, you know, Jesus pretty much would have kept the Mosaic Law. He differed in how it could be interpreted, but that he kept it, and so we will do. And so when non-Jews come in, I think I told the group the first day that one time a young fellow asked me after, it was at the break of a class, and he asked me, could I clarify again the difference between a Jew and a Gentile? So simply by Gentile here, meaning people who are not Jewish, unless, of course, you're in Utah, in which case, if you're in Utah and you're not a Mormon, you're a Gentile. So in the state of Utah today, Jews are Gentiles, but, right? That wasn't very deep, but, you know, it's Saturday night. Okay, then there's a second view. The second and third view we actually see argued out in the text of the New Testament. One view says, believers in Jesus need not be circumcised, but must observe some Jewish practices. So I think you could call this a real middle-of-the-road approach. Look, we don't, you know, Jesus doesn't lead us to make a radical break with our past, but, you know, maybe it's not necessary. And this probably was very practical because, when adults came to join the community of the believers in Jesus, adult males, let's just say that the thought of being circumcised would not have been attractive at that point in their lives. Right? You get the... Okay. Now, we don't know all that's behind this, but this is a view especially associated with Peter and James. And if you recall, in the 15th chapter, Mike, if you have time after tonight, if you could stay awake long enough, if you read the Acts of the Apostles, the 15th chapter, you see that Peter and James are taken on by Paul. And that Paul's position is that Gentile believers, when Paul is talking about the law, he's particularly talking about what Gentiles who come into the community should do or not do. Gentile believers in Jesus need neither be circumcised nor keep Jewish dietary practices. And Peter and James have a different view. And they work out a kind of a compromise in Jerusalem about all this. This Galatians text refers to when Paul confronts Peter and James, and Paul's Josephus there in Galatians, in the city of Antioch. And they work out there are certain things that are imposed upon all Gentiles who come into the community. They need not, that they have to refrain from eating meat that's sacrificed, in which the blood has not been properly taken care of, and so forth. But so here you see two views about their relationship to the Jewish community. Then there's a fourth point of view, the opposite of the first. Believers in Jesus have no lasting connection with Judaism. I think in the 60s this was an extreme view. It probably is associated with Jews who came from a Greek background, who were called Hellenistic Jews, who would have had a different take on Judaism than, say, people who were Aramaic-speaking, or they're simply called Hebrew. And in Acts 6, you have a story about a conflict between Hellenistic Jews and Hebrews. They're both Jews, one Greek-speaking and the other Aramaic or Hebrew-speaking, and that there are cultural differences there that are a divide. And there's a problem because the Hellenists don't think that their widows are properly being cared for. Now, this thing here, this position here, believers have no lasting connection with Judaism, is, I think, something that is a distinctly minority position in the 60s. This tension between Peter and James on the one hand and Paul on the other is, I think, the major debate of the middle part of the century there. Later on, this comes after 70, when Jerusalem is destroyed. Jerusalem ceases to become a very central part of what becomes Christian life. The centers of the church become places like Ephesus and Rome and Antioch. And there comes in here into play among some people some real hostility toward Jews and toward Judaism. And this has an influence on certain New Testament texts, because the New Testament texts, the majority of the three of the Gospels are written much closer to the end of the century than they are, say, to this middle part. So in Hebrews, you have a very negative portrayal of Jewish worship, particularly in chapters 9 and 10. In John, you have layers of John's Gospel that are quite negative about the Jews. It's very evident, for instance, that the Jews in John's Gospel are blamed for the crucifixion of Jesus. Now, next week I want to talk about what have been some of the practical effects of that charge that the Jews killed Jesus. I think that we have to look at that historically. What over 2,000 years has that charge meant? There's a very infamous passage in the 8th chapter of John's Gospel, 8:44, I think, in which Jesus is portrayed as saying, you Jews are the children of the devil. And that passage doesn't fortunately occur in the lectionary very much, probably for good reason. There are a couple nasty passages in the book of Revelation about the Satan of the Jews and so forth. And I think that this negative, this develops both because this was the ideological perspective. We don't have any lasting connection with our roots. And also because after 70, the situation becomes much more complicated and you have another problem. Let's say that by the end of the century, they were going to be called Christians, even though they're still not separate. You don't really have clearly separable communities until well into the second century, and then not everywhere. Probably in 4th and 5th, and even later, in certain rural areas like rural Syria, people who were believers in Jesus, who would have been called Christians, still did not see themselves as entirely separate from Jews. And it's one of the things I'm going to talk about next week, I think on Tuesday, talk about what really happened in the partings of the ways and why did it happen. But this has a disproportionate effect on the writing of the Gospels. I think if we had Gospels that were more shaped by Paul or by this tension, we wouldn't have the kind of the wholesale negative portrayal of the Pharisees, for instance. You'll recall that Paul himself was brought up in the Pharisaic party or school of thought. Well, it may be that as you sort of look at this, you say, well, this is interesting information, but it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't change my life and doesn't, you know, get at perhaps, you know, sort of the spiritual wisdom of Christianity. And I think that is, on a superficial level, true. It's an interesting fact. But I think if you begin to really wrestle with some of the implications of the negative way we portray Judaism, we can see that we have really oversimplified so grossly our story of origins. And we've done it in a way that puts another people down. And then we have oversimplified our own story so that we come to kind of a simplistic notion of our own faith. And I rather like the more complex Jesus that happens when you read the Gospels. You don't just see Jesus over against other Jews. And you begin to sort of really probe, what was it that Jesus was trying to renew in Israel? And why was that renewal so hard? And why is the Christian life so hard? The other thing that I think has a very practical effect, this is the last comment I'll make this evening. You know, when you read the Acts of the Apostles, there's this a beautiful summary in the second chapter of Acts, and it talks about how they were all gathered together in the temple. You know, they prayed daily, they shared all their goods in common. And I don't know about you, but I read these passages sometimes and I think of some of the pettiness and the power plays and the parochialism of churches. I mean, I've been part of the institutional church for a long time, and you know, the more you're part of the church, you see its power and you also see its sinfulness, right? You know, there's plenty of reason if you work in the church to be disillusioned. And you look back at the early church and it just looks so wonderful. You know, how they all went to the temple. And then you read some of the other passages in the Acts of the Apostles, which we don't really take in. We don't take in that the big three, as it were, in the 60s, are violently disagreeing with one. When I say violently disagreeing, I don't mean they, you know, got physical. But this is a real, real controversy. And the people, the Gentiles, may have been attracted to the teaching of Judaism because of its ethics, but they don't know much, and if you're somebody who's been really deeply influenced by Judaism, and then you're sitting next to some ignorant Gentile, and then you got Samaritans in the mix, and if you recall Paul's letter to Corinth, even if people were sort of more or less of one mind view in terms of how they've been formed, they were always arguing about, you know, who baptized you? Apollos? Cephas? Paul, I got baptized by Paul, I'm better than you are. Or I have this gift. I have the gift of tongues. And you, you know. So what I'm trying to get at is that the more we can see that the early church was a process and not a finished product, the more we might have some patience with our own church. So it's time I see people trailing the Vespers. So maybe what we can do is kind of take this all in prayer to Vespers and see that, you know, look around this Christian community and say, we come from a lot of different backgrounds, and we could have our Peter, James, and Paul arguing with one another, but the point is, you know, who is the God to whom Jesus calls us, and what is that vision? So that's it for this evening, and I wish you a very happy Sabbath tomorrow.
Thank you.